as he doesn't care. 10 fingers and 10 toes is all he's hoping for, but I know better. Every man wants a son, and Henry has waited far too long for his. It would be a lie to say I didn't pray every day that this baby will be a boy. The son Suzanne has never been able to give him, not to best her, but to ease the pain of all those other losses. My belly swells as the months rush past, and at first the days are a blur. The upstairs needs papering, and the bed needs to be moved to make way for the bassinet. The child will need things, too, bottles and blankets and diapers, but goods are hard to come by these days. No one's buying anything, and when they do find a few spare pennies, the store shelves are nearly bare. I can still get cloth and thread, though, and Mama made sure I was good with a needle, so at least Henry's child won't run naked. I scare up one of Henry's old cigar boxes to make a sewing box and set my chair near the window where the light is good and I can see the leaves beginning to turn. Now and then, I let myself wonder what Maggie will think when the baby comes. I wonder if she will grow to love the child or if she will see it as a rival. She's got a good, sweet heart in her, but she has always worshipped her daddy. It will be hard, I think, for her to share him with someone else. In fact, I'm not sure she's quite keen on having to share him with me. She gets a look sometimes, when she thinks I don't see, confusion mingled with hurt, and maybe a little anger, too, as if she's wishing me 1,000 miles away. As for Suzanne, I do not let myself think about what her reaction will be when she finally spies my belly from her window. I keep close to the cottage most days, working the small patch of garden behind the kitchen where I can't be seen from the house. Lottie comes by now and then to take home a handful of whatever's ready for picking and leave a bit of whatever she's been cooking. She tries to give me news from the house, but I don't want it. I don't want to hear how crazy Suzanne's been acting or how bad she looks. Instead, we talk about the town, what latest family has lost its farm, and who's been put out of work. When she comes by just before Christmas, she tells me Celia Cunningham's husband got caught taking money from the bank and was likely going to jail. That last part makes me feel just a little bit good. Then I remember they have 2 girls, tiny things in grade school, and I feel sorry. Spring is slow in coming, the days raw and perpetually wet. By the end of March, I am miserable, tired to death of being indoors, of endlessly, endlessly waiting. But if I am restless, Henry is worse. His eyes go with me everywhere, greeting me at the end of each day with the same unspoken question. And each day my answer is the same. Not yet. I'm alone when the first pain comes, tearing me from a warm, deep sleep. I blink at the sheets, bone white in the splash of moonlight streaming through the window, and try not to panic. Beyond the dark panes there is only night sky and the cold prickle of stars. It will be hours before Henry comes, and then he'll still have to fetch the midwife. I'm not sure the child will wait. 1 hour later my water lets go and I start to pray. Not the prayers of a woman full grown, but snatches of the words Mama taught me to say when I was little, silly bits of rhyme that catch in my throat between sobs. The pains are coming harder now, and my back feels fit to break. I watch the sky, petrified as I try not to think of that awful night in Suzanne's room and the look on Henry's face when his son slid into the world silent and blue. By the time I finally hear Henry's voice echo up the stairs, I have lost all sense of time. I don't know how he knew to come. I am only thankful to God that he has. I sob with relief when he appears in the doorway, his hair still disheveled from sleep, eyes wide with panic. He drops to his knees beside the bed, his calloused fingers gentle as he pushes the hair back from my sticky face. Is everything... He doesn't finish. He doesn't have to. Before I can utter a word, another contraction grabs hold, turning me inside out. Go! I grit through my teeth. Bring her, quick! The sky has gone a dull shade of pink when I hear Henry's truck finally rattle back up the drive. It's none too soon. I am near senseless now, my body battered and limp. I can endure no more on my own. Then comes the slow, steady tread of feet on the stairs, and when I turn my head on the pillow, she is there, bulky and slightly stooped in her wool kerchief and worn cloth coat, her skin the color of polished mahogany in the dim lamplight. Minnie Ma Spates, the midwife from the hills of Level Grove who once sent her tonics to Suzanne. She wastes no time. She sets a heavy cloth bag at the foot of the bed, her jaw squarely set as she surveys the situation. Her eyes meet mine briefly as she peels out of her coat and kerchief. There is no softness there, no pity or warmth of any kind, only a calm resolve to be about her business of bringing another child into the world. She peers under the sheets, then prods my belly with firm, practiced hands, pausing until the latest wave of agony releases me. Henry hovers behind her, wide-eyed and anxious, dwarfed somehow by her presence. She has brought a girl with her, too, a stringy child about Maggie's age, all elbows and knees and great white eyes as she huddles in the corner, staring at me, panting with my knees up around my ears.
The child's coming, Minnie announces to no one in particular. Be here right along with the sun, I expect.
She turns to Henry then, tilting her wiry gray head toward the door.
Time for you to get on out now.
Henry's boots scuff heavily, but he does not move.
Mr. Henry,
she says with her bottom lip jutting,
I've brung over 200 babies in my time, your little girl among 'em. I reckon I can bring this one without your help.
His eyes shift to mine, anxious, helpless. I try to find a smile, but can't manage it. I cannot worry about Henry now. The next wave of pain is already gathering, waiting to crash over me, to bury me. Go on now, I tell him raggedly. I'm calmer with Henry gone, though the pains are coming one on top of the other now. No time to breathe, no time to prepare. I lose track of Minnie as she shuffles about the room, readying a small tray of things at the foot of the bed. I'm so tired and so sore, like my insides are all ripped to bits. If I could only sleep a little.
Annie Mae Spates?
Minnie's voice is like a whip-crack, jolting me back to something like awareness, though some small part of me understands it isn't me she's talking to.
You come out from that corner and help Minnie Mae now,
she says over her shoulder.
I didn't tote you with me to stand there with your eyes closed. It's time you learned what's what.
Annie Mae does as she's told, emerging reluctantly from her corner, though she's plainly terrified, doing everything in her power not to let her eyes settle on me or on what might be going on beneath the clean white sheet tented over my knees.
This here's Annie Mae,
Minnie says, still fishing around in her bag.
Belongs to my oldest boy. I brought her along to learn. I was already helping my mama when I was her age, but Annie Mae is a little skittish. Doesn't like it when the hollering starts.
I feel bad for Annie Mae, because I can see she'd rather be anywhere than where she is at this moment, and because I know full well that the hollering is about to start. Minnie draws a rusty-looking knife from her bag, pausing a moment to run a finger along the edge of the blade. For the first time, something like a smile crosses her lips.
Don't mean nothing, but I still do it,
she says, dropping the knife beneath the bed with a clatter,
because my mama always did it.
I muster a smile for the familiar words and lift my head weakly.
Because it cuts the pain in two?
Minnie nods, then moves to my head, dragging me up against my pillows. That's right, child. Now, get yourself ready. Me and you got some work to do.
Chapter 27. Leslie. Leslie dubiously eyed the mess surrounding her. Sketches, legal pads, sticky notes, and newspaper clippings, all organized into haphazard piles around her laptop. It was one of the pitfalls of living alone. Because there was no one to share a meal with and no one to complain, one's kitchen table gradually morphed into a kind of makeshift desk until one eventually found oneself eating over the sink. It hadn't gotten that bad yet, but it was certainly heading in that direction. She could have used the desk in the study, but the truth was, she found the room and all its sad reminders a little disquieting, as if she was never quite alone. Once again, her thoughts strayed to the shed fire and the article she still couldn't bring herself to throw away. It had nothing to do with Adele, nothing to do with anything, really, and yet she couldn't shake the feeling that it did mean something. She recalled the names at the bottom of the page. Samuel, Randall, and Landis Porter, the boys the police had questioned. Were any of them still alive? And if so, would they be able to tell her anything? It was a silly idea, she knew. They would be Maggie's age by now or older. Still, the urge to do a little investigating was there, nudging her to abandon her work, which was something she really couldn't afford to do. To quote Jay, the harvest had been an unqualified success. No equipment issues, perfect picking weather, and an even better than expected yield. She wanted to be able to say the same about the splash, and with less than 2 weeks to finalize things, she didn't have time to go on a wild goose chase. Forcing her brain back to the matter at hand, she picked up this morning's Gazette, studying the slightly grainy shot of Jay and Young Buck working the crush pad. She had been pleasantly surprised to see the harvest story had made the front page. Must have been a slow news day, not that she was complaining. It was a great piece, even better than the first, which had already generated a nice bit of buzz with the locals. She needed to send Steve Whitney a great big thanks. She had just opened her email inbox when a quick tap sounded on the mudroom door. A minute later, Angie poked her head around the corner. I made a double batch of lasagna last night. Thought I'd bring some by and keep you from having to cook. Keep me from having to microwave, you mean? Leslie shot back. But thanks. Angie set the plate on the counter, eyes widening as she scanned the kitchen table. Wow. When you said you had a lot of ideas for this shindig of yours, you weren't kidding. I've got a whole new respect for party planners these days, I can tell you that. But at least I can focus now that the harvest is over and done. She made a face as she rubbed her backside. Speaking of which, I can't believe I'm still sore. I can. A corner office doesn't exactly prepare you for picking 70 acres of grapes. You did great, though. Jay was impressed with how you pitched right in. By the way, I couldn't help noticing you two seem to be getting along better. Anything you'd like to share? Leslie looked away, pretending to tidy a stack of sketches. No, there wasn't anything she'd like to share, mostly because she had no idea what, if anything, had actually started that night in Jay's kitchen. It was a handful of kisses over a sink full of dishes, and with the bustle and prep for harvest, they really hadn't seen much of each other since, and never alone. Not that either one of them seemed in any great hurry to find out what came next. We're taking it slow, Leslie answered finally, whatever that means. Angie wasted no time and pounced. So there is something there. I don't know. Maybe. We kissed and it was nice. Amazing. Funny, Angie responded dryly.
I could have sworn I heard the word amazing come out of your mouth just then. So how come you look like someone just ran over your prize pig?
Leslie chose to ignore both the sarcasm and the humor.
Because amazing can get you into all kinds of trouble, and I don't know if I'm ready for a serious relationship yet.
Yet? Angie snorted, then leveled hard green eyes on Leslie.
I hate to break it to you, honey, but you're staring down the barrel of 40. You think you might be getting ready anytime soon?
Leslie winced.
There it was, that right between the eyes honesty Angie hauled out when she wanted to get your attention.
Angie, this isn't about age or biological clocks or any of that. It's about whether I'm ready to open my life up to someone. Aside from you and Buck, I don't know too many people that's actually worked out for, which is why I'm not sure I see the point in starting something that's only going to end up being temporary.
Who says it has to be temporary?
I do. I have some history with this.
Leslie, most of us get it wrong the first time, but we have to keep trying.
Why?
Because the alternative is being alone.
She paused, bringing her tone down a notch.
Look, I'm not trying to push Jay down your throat.
Well, maybe a little.
But it's because I don't want to see you make up your mind about forever based on a few bumps in your past. Don't close the door is all I'm saying. I'm going to leave now before I get thrown out. Come by the house later for coffee if you have time. No sermons, I promise.
Leslie slid back into her chair, listening to the slap of Angie's flip-flops receding down the back porch steps. Her advice had been kindly meant, the words of a friend, however bluntly spoken. But it wasn't that simple. She was scared, though, of what she couldn't say. She'd been in relationships before, had survived her fair share of breakups, sustained the usual nicks and bruises to her pride. So why was this so different?
It was a question she'd been asking herself for days now, though she wasn't at all sure she was ready to face the answer, that with Jay there was more than just her pride on the line, and that she might already be in too deep to walk away.
Leslie blinked at her laptop, trying to recall what she'd been about to do before Angie popped in, when she spotted the brand new message in her inbox from Doug Summers. Her stomach clenched as she opened it, praying he and Stephen hadn't changed their minds about subletting her apartment. The last thing she needed right now was one more distraction. But the email wasn't about the apartment at all.
Les, just an FYI. Some guy came around yesterday looking for you. Claimed to be your father. Didn't tell him anything except that you had moved. Asked if I knew where. Told him no. Thought you should know. The guy looked a little worse for wear. D.
Leslie slumped back in her chair and closed her eyes, forcing herself to breathe slowly. Jimmy was out, then, in New York, and apparently hot on her trail. At least she'd been given a heads up. It was unlikely that he'd heard about Maggie's death or her inheritance. Peak might not occur to him. But if it did... She thought of the proceeds from her watch stashed in the top drawer of her bureau, allocated for things like tent rental, lighting and decorations, and the band she'd already hired. It would get him to go away, at least for a while. And then what? When it was gone, he'd be back. She shut down the laptop and sat very still, listening to the faint whir of the refrigerator and the steady tick-tock of the kitchen clock. She had spent the first 8 years of her life at Peak, but had returned as a stranger. Now, somehow, while she wasn't looking, it had become her home. Not the kind of home she'd had in New York, a small, sterile space carved out of concrete and glass, but a real home where her heart could live and breathe. There were people in her life now, Angie and young Buck, and a strawberry blonde 8-year-old who called her Aunt Leslie, and somewhere in all of it, there was Jay. She had become part of a circle,
part of the life and purpose that pulsed through Peak, and she liked it. Jimmy wasn't ruining that. Let him come if he wanted, but he wasn't staying, and he wasn't getting a cent.
For all her resolve, Leslie almost jumped out of her chair when her cell phone went off. No one ever called these days. Peering at the display, she saw that the number was local, though it wasn't one she knew. It took a moment to recognize the voice on the other end.
Mr. Randolph?
Do you have a minute to talk? I've just had a call about your painting. Turns out it's a bit of a rarity.
Leslie grabbed a Diet Coke from the fridge and stepped out onto the back porch, concerns about Jimmy temporarily on the back burner. A rarity in what way?
Well, for starters, it appears to have been painted by a rather obscure artist, a man by the name of Tanner, who painted in Paris between 1905 and 1915 or so.
Leslie dropped heavily into the nearest rocker. I'm sorry, did you say Tanner?
She had seen the name before, in the articles her mother had saved about addiction and mental illness. Now here it was again, directly connected to the Rebecca.
I did. Jeremiah Tanner was his full name. He was a minor artist in his day, had a reputation as a bit of a ne'er-do-well, but after his death in 1917, his work started to gain attention. There are 6 known works of merit attributed to him, and somehow your great-grandfather managed to get a hold of 5 of them.
Do you have any idea
how much it's worth? No, I'm afraid I don't. It's difficult when there are no recent sales on which to base a price. I haven't given up yet, though. There's one more painting out there we haven't accounted for, and the trail ends with a man named Fournier, a gallery owner who once owned the entire collection. Apparently, he got mixed up with some unsavory political types and had to emigrate from France to avoid arrest. That was back in 37 or 38. We're fairly certain he brought the paintings with him, though we believe they were liquidated not long after.
Is there a way to know who may have bought them?
That's what I'm calling to tell you. The Fournier Gallery is still operating.
Leslie watched a pair of cardinals vying for the bird feeder leftovers as she digested this bit of news.
He's still alive?
Good heavens, no. Claude Fournier died in 72. His granddaughter owns the place now. I tried to get in touch with her to see if she knew the fate of the collection, but all I got was a recording that the gallery is closed for the season. I'm afraid we'll have to wait until it reopens in the spring. At any rate, we don't need the painting anymore if you'd like to pick it up.
Thank you, Mr. Randolph.
Leslie tried to keep the frustration from her voice. Spring was an eternity away.
I'll be by in a day or two, if that's all right. In the meantime, would you mind if I tried to get in touch with Fournier's granddaughter?
Not at all. It's your painting. I'd be obliged, though, if you'd let me know what you find out. This will probably sound silly to you, but in my line of work, you learn that old things tend to have stories. And something tells me this one might be a doozy.
Leslie didn't think it sounded silly at all. Things did have stories. Photos and paintings and gravestones had stories, and like Mr. Randolph, she wanted to know what they were and why she couldn't shake the feeling that those stories were somehow connected. After jotting down the number for the Charleston Gallery, she ended the call. 2 hours later, she was still waiting to hear back from Miss Fournier. She had reached the same recorded message as Mr. Randolph. The gallery was closed for the season and would reopen on March 1st. She hadn't bothered to leave a message. Instead, she hopped online. It had taken less than 30 minutes to locate an address and phone number for Miss Emily Fournier of Charleston, South Carolina. Her message was short and sweet.
She would like to speak with Miss Fournier at her earliest convenience with regard to several paintings from her grandfather's private collection. It was presumptuous, she knew, and would probably turn out to be a huge waste of time, but it was the only lead she had. She couldn't do anything now, but when the splash was behind her, she'd have some free time. If it was wasted, so be it. At least she would know she had tried. She was finishing up a few emails the next morning when her cell phone went off. She immediately recognized the 843 area code. The voice on the other end was cool and brisk, opening with a series of rapid-fire questions. How had she gotten this number? Was she a collector? A dealer? Was she looking to make a purchase? Inexplicably, Leslie found herself tongue-tied. She had tracked the woman down at home on a Sunday, and now that she was on the line, she didn't know where to begin. In the end, she decided to keep Mr. Randolph out of it, saying only that she had inherited a painting that might be the work of Jeremiah Tanner, and that since her grandfather had been a collector of Tanner's work, she hoped Miss Fournier might be able to authenticate the piece. It took a bit of doing, but Emily Fournier finally agreed to view the Rebecca, scheduling an appointment at her home on the Tuesday after the splash. Leslie felt almost giddy as she ended the call. It would only be a day trip, but she could do with a change of scenery. Maybe she'd invite Jay along. It was time they got to know each other better, time to stop all the wary circling and finally figure out what they wanted from each other. By late afternoon, she had finally screwed up the courage to actually extend the invitation. She found Jay out behind the cottage in his garden. She paused at the gate, watching him turn what was left of the herb beds. When he finally looked up, he seemed startled. "Ah, you're just in time to help." "With what? It looks like you're almost finished."
"With this part? Yeah, but then I'm planting some winter lettuce."
"You're quite the Renaissance man." She stepped through the gate, letting it close behind her. "Have you got a minute? There's something I want to talk to you about."
"All right. I was about to get myself some tea. Can I bring you out a glass?"
Leslie nodded, though she wasn't thirsty. She wondered how Jay would react when she told him she was going all the way to Charleston on the hunch that there was a connection between Adele and the paintings in Henry's study. He'd already questioned her once, accusing her rather heatedly of letting Adele get under her skin. Well, maybe she was. But her gut told her she was onto something, and her conversation with Mr. Randolph only served to strengthen that conviction. Jay reappeared with a glass in each hand and a bag of pretzels between his teeth. Leslie relieved him of the pretzels and one of the glasses.
"Let's sit a minute,"
he suggested, pointing to a shady stretch of stone wall.
"My back is killing me."
Leslie dropped down beside him on the mossy stones, feeling the cool damp seep through the seat of her jeans. Jay tore into the pretzels, then offered her the bag, but she declined. "I'm going to Charleston the Tuesday after the splash," she said without preamble. Jay blinked at her.
"What's in Charleston?"
"An art gallery, or rather, the owner of an art gallery. Her name is Emily Fournier."
"Does this have to do with your photography?"
"My photography?" Leslie frowned, then shook her head. "No. It's about the paintings in Henry's study. There's a woman who owns a gallery there who might be able to give me some information on them."
"You do realize Charleston is almost 6 hours away?"
"I do."
"And just what is it you'd drive 6 hours to find out?"
"I had someone look at one of the paintings, an expert. He said it was painted by a man named Jeremiah Tanner. Apparently, he only painted 6 pictures, which means Henry was one shy of owning the entire collection. Before that, the collection belonged to a man named Fournier from Charleston."
Leslie paused, plucking a pretzel from the bag. "Unfortunately, no one knows what happened to them after they left Fournier's hands. It's like they vanished, except 5 of the 6 are hanging in Henry's study."
Jay looked mystified. "That's it?
You're going to drive all the way to South Carolina to find out why your great-grandfather had a study full of paintings. Leslie, Henry was fairly well off and at a time when no one trusted the banks. Maybe he saw art as a safe place to park his money. Leslie sipped her sweet tea as she considered the idea. Plausible enough given the economic climate after the crash, but something still didn't feel right. Finally, she shook her head. No, that wasn't it. Other than Maggie's portrait in the parlor and the one of Suzanne up in the attic, there isn't another scrap of art in the house. Why these paintings? Why Tanner?